To our Black Book Talk listeners, we have a real treat in store for you today. Author Brendan Slocum introduces his latest novel, Dark Maestro, an exciting mystery with plot twists galore. We apologize in advance for audio problems with one of our microphones, not author Slocum's. You can hear him loud and clear, so sit back and enjoy the interview. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to the July edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, here with
O.B. Hill, community historian.
Patricia Welch, librarian emeritus.
This morning, our guest is an old friend, Brendan Slocum, author of the newly published book, Dark Maestro. Welcome, Brendan. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here.
You've written two other books, The Violin Conspiracy and Symphony of Secrets. Can you tell us a little bit about Dark Maestro?
Basically, Dark Maestro is a story of a young man named Curtis who lives in a not so great environment in Southeast DC. He has a father as a petty drug dealer, and Curtis enjoys playing the cello. He works really hard at it. And then when he reaches the pinnacle of his career, his life is basically snatched away because his father's drug dealings cause him to have to go into witness protection, and he can no longer play his cello. So the family is struggling to deal with their new identities, and they have to, the FBI is not working nearly fast enough to get them their life back. So they take matters into their own hands.
That they do.
The book is dealing with a five-year-old who has a passion for two things. One is music and the other one is comic books. Could you explain how he began to read and get involved with that?
Sure. The comic book angle actually came from me. I have been a huge comic collector since I was 15 years old, and I've got a collection that is just out of control right now. I've got over 15,000 comic books sitting here in my office. And it basically came from his mother figure, Larissa. She just wanted to do something nice for Curtis since he was doing so well. And it's been a lifelong love for him alongside playing the cello.
All of your books center on, a violinist or violin and classical music. So this time we have that. We have comic books. So we have superheroes. But we have some show enough gangsters in here. We have rap lyrics. I was like, who wrote these rhymes? And that is one of the questions I wanted to ask. Did you do the rhymes? Where did this come from? I mean, is there another career that you have that we don't know about?
One of these days, I'm actually going to put hip hop and rap together with classical music. I'm going to make that happen one of these days. But right now, I'm focused on the writing. And I wish I was talented enough to be able to do lyrics like you read in The Dark Maestro. And I'm assuming that you thought they were pretty good because you're referencing
them
now. Okay, all right, that's good. So that was done by a good friend of mine named Jordan Rodriguez. His stage name is J.O. Blanco, and he is going to be a major, major star. This is one of the most hardworking. He not only is a nice guy, he's extremely talented. So I called him up one day and said, hey, I'm doing this book. I need some rap lyrics. I'm not a rapper. I know that you are. Can you help me out? And he was generous enough to provide all of the lyrics to everything that was done by Curtis and Zippy.
This is a thick book, and so were the other two. Do you have to take time off work? How long does it take to do a book like this?
Well, when you say it's a thick book, I think that scares people away. I want them to know, even though it does have a lot of pages, it's an easy read. It's a page turner, I like to think, as with the other two. Please give me like you guys can co-sign on that if you want.
It is. It's a page turner. Yeah, I was up most of the night, that first night, reading it, and then got up the next morning and started right away because I wanted to see what was going to happen.
Yeah, it's definitely a thick book. When I write, I dedicate that time to writing, to nothing else. I have a regular routine. I write 2,500 words a day, and then I start with the editing process, but I write until I'm done. So until I type that last period, that's what I do every day at the same time.
And I want to further say that at my house, you have a fan club. When I lay that book down on the coffee table, then my son and grandson know either of you can read it next because we've read all three of your books.
Oh, thank you.
Who did the graphics on this book? The cover, you have a mask, violin. The colors are just vivid.
Oh, well, that's really nice to hear. That was my design team at Doubleday. They totally did it. They came up with the concept, which I think is actually great. The book design is by Nicholas Alguire and Oliver Monday. They did a fantastic job. This was their concept. And I was like, I think it fits perfectly with the theme of the story.
I just want to say just a third remark on the size of the book. This book has to be that long because there are so many plot twists and so much that you have to follow. You couldn't have all that in a shorter book. And I'll say to people who are approaching the book, you don't know. You think you know. But whatever it is, you don't know what's going to happen in this book. But what I also liked is that you don't know about these characters. I'm really sort of fascinated with the character of Zippy. Mm-hmm. Because he was a teen father. He's in a neighborhood where, you know, corporate recruiters are not going to come and get him. And so he is doing the best that he can. When he became a father, his commitment to that child is paramount in his life. So I want to tell us a little bit about Zippy, but also tell us a little bit about the other characters, because they're not who you may immediately think they are.
Right. I'm glad you said that. They actually went through a lot of development in this story, and I was very happy with their progression throughout the story. Zippy is, you know, he was, like you mentioned, a very young father. He was definitely committed to his son, Curtis, to the mother figures in his life, not so much. He went through a bunch of them before Larissa kind of calmed him down. And Zippy he's very intelligent, very, very intelligent, maybe a bit misguided, but very intelligent. He's a numbers guy. He had dreams and aspirations of becoming an accountant. And, you know, they called him numbers when he went certain places. That's numbers over there. So his development, I thought he grew up a lot with Curtis, you know, being such a young father and having to take care of him. There are lots of things that Zippy just didn't know. And he was able to grow with Curtis. Curtis was able to show him things and teach him how things should be done from father to son, which I thought was fantastic. And Zippy himself, you know, he was smart enough to pick up on things and know when he was wrong, with a little prodding from Larissa, the mother figure, who, believe it or not, a lot of people comment that she's the favorite character throughout the story because of not only her personality, but what she does in the community, and just, you know, being the type of person that she is, the loving mother figure for Curtis. You know, I think she would move heaven and earth to make sure Curtis was taken care of.
Yes. And she's a nurturer, I feel, to everybody, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, not just Curtis, but I think, you know, there's so many stereotypes about young fathers who abandon their children or whatever. And that was not him. He and Larissa were both in the gang. What is it? 18ST. Mm-hmm. So, and there are stereotypes about people in gangs. And yet from the very time that we meet Larissa, she is looking out for the women who are in the gang. When she gets a more, conventional job, she is looking out, but she is a person who you can turn to. And I just thought, you know, we need to see these kind of things. And even in what's like this is a fun summer read, and it's a page turner, but it also presents some images that I think it's important that we see. So I thank you for that.
My pleasure. And I absolutely agree 100%. I like to show people, you know, I'm writing from my perspective, and there is so much more to us than what people think they know. And it's important for novels like this to be shared, you know, throughout this, you know, society and throughout the world, so people can actually get a glimpse of, you know, what it's like and how we manage to deal with things. And it's not always, you know, guns and shooting and bad. Not always. We know how to conduct ourselves and you know, have a good life.
I love that you gave Ziggy a mother. She was someone that I felt like I knew from the time you introduced the character.
Oh, that's good. That's good. You know, it's funny. My first draft, when I wrote Larissa, my editor couldn't even remember her name because she was so boring and inconsequential. So I had to go back and do some rewrites on her and make her a bit more strong and prominent and, you know, taking a lead in a lot of sections of the story. So I'm glad that worked out.
No, I'm talking about the mom.
Oh.
His mom.
Oh, Patricia.
Yes.
yeah, Patricia was something else. Just give her a pack of cigarettes and she's happy.
Oh, wait, no, she got to have a card game.
Yeah, a deck.
When I was mentioning those card games, I just remembered what my parents would play. You know, either people would come over or they would go to someone's house and they were going to play, you know, spades or bidwiz or tongue or whatever. And I had no idea how to play any of those games, but I knew they loved them. So, hey, let's put them in the book.
That's good.
You have law enforcement personnel. You start right off with a guy walking out on the stage and his FBI side agent along with him. Then all of a sudden, they're putting into under custody. This is, what do you know about the whole law enforcement industry?
Well, fortunately, I haven't been on the receiving end of any bad things with the law enforcement. I'm a good guy. Just want everybody out there to know that. None of this comes from personal experience. I actually had a friend who had recently retired from being a U.S. Marshal, and he was able to give me a lot of information that he couldn't give me when he was working. So I do appreciate his time and knowledge that he was sharing it. I mean, I learned just everything that people from witness protection, what they have to go through in order to be able to qualify and stay in the program. It's one thing if you actually make it into the program and your identity has changed and you move, but it's like the list of violations is incredibly long and incredibly specific. You do anything that jeopardizes your identity, you are out. And it's like, I don't mean, oh, we're just going to move you someplace else. You are out of the program. It's like, we will just, okay, you're on your own. And if the people that are after you find you, it's your own fault. And it's kind of brutal in a sense, but yeah, there's a lot more to it than just go move to someplace else and now you live life happily ever after. There's a lot more to it.
The whole thing about like the Oregon, I felt like it was organ stealing because, I mean, basically, you know, like telling people you're going to pay them money for some body part, their liver, their whatever. Again, I learned more about that than I expected in a book about a violinist. I said, why did you choose that? I mean, there are a lot of things you could have written about. There are a lot of, obviously, because you have, there are a lot of different angles. What attracted you to this particular crime?
Well, it was not done out of curiosity, that's for sure. I was actually going through a lot of medical issues and I found out I had to have a kidney transplant. And that really led the story because I was experiencing that and trying to write. And I found out a great deal about, you know, organ harvesting and just how it's more prevalent than you would think. You know, it happens undercover. It happens at night in dark alleys. People are kidnapped or people are persuaded into, you know, they're coerced into coming into places thinking they're going to get one thing, but all they end up, you know, if they leave at all, you know, they leave with less than they came in with. They thought they were getting a ton of money, but they end up leaving with only one kidney, or they die and the heart and the liver and everything is harvested. It's a really, really brutal underworld aspect that goes on daily. And I'm hoping that this story will, you know, bring a little bit of attention to that. I just read the other day where something like this in Arkansas was actually a ring was busted. They were harvesting organs from people in Arkansas, and you know, it happens a lot more than people think. So, you know, just be aware. Don't let false hopes of money and easy cash, you know, cause you to lose a kidney, because that would not be cool.
I love how you showed resilience. For the young people reading the book, they see this prodigy, this musical prodigy, who is no longer able to do what he's trained his whole life for. But yet, he springs back. He has another avenue. I love how you showed that.
Resilience is a very important message that will always be throughout all of my stories. I think that it's one of those things that people take lightly. You never know how far you would have to go, how far you would have to push yourself, how far you're able to go if you lose something. And in Curtis's case, with not being able to perform on cello anymore, you know, that's, like you mentioned, that's one thing that he's been working his entire life for, the one thing that he absolutely loves and is able to do and do well, can no longer do it. It's been taken away from him. But instead of giving up, you know, of course you can be sad and you will mourn. There will be a time of mourning, but you know, you've got to pick yourself up and keep going, because no one else is going to do it for you. You know, resilience is extremely important. We all have a degree of resilience within us. It's just a matter of how far you're willing to dig to, you know, make it known. And I'm just really happy that it shows that you can find that strength. You can find it through family. You can find it through friends and supporters. It's always, and you can definitely find it through your faith. I have definitely learned that, you know, because I'm not supposed to be here right now. Like twice, I should have died. And my faith led to strength in my resilience, and I am still here. And I always want to share that message.
In kindergarten, Curtis received his first cello, a beat up. Well, it wasn't the type of instrument that we're used to playing. And so how did he go about making that particular selection?
Now, when you say, Mr. Obi, when you say we, are you referring to Black people, Black society? What are you talking about?
Yes, because the book is about different cultures, mm-hmm, and different status symbols. And the cello and orchestras, philharmonic, etc., is something that we are really, as a people, not that much into.
Right. I agree 100%. And that is also a running theme in a lot of my books. It's not customary to see a lot of Black people playing stringed instruments. Goodness knows, when I was growing up, it was just like, you know, who is that? Who is this guy? You know, why are you doing this? And I get it. I wanted to bring awareness. If you want to play a stringed instrument, if you want to play a flute, if you want to play an oboe, if you want to play a trombone, whatever it is that you want to play, you know, it's not, I want people to understand and realize that it is not for a specific type of person. It's for everyone. It should be everyone's to enjoy and to experience and to share. Even in, if you have the worst, if you're in the worst neighborhood in the world, worst neighborhood in DC, you should still be allowed the opportunity to play a musical instrument that could, you never know what it could do for you. I'm living proof that, you know, music will save your life. Curtis is an example of music saving your life. Same thing with Ray and the Violin Conspiracy. And one connecting factor that I really enjoyed putting in all three of these books is that the Laney Foundation was able to contribute instruments to people all across the world who did not have access to them. That's an important lesson that I want people to get. It doesn't matter what your skin color is. It doesn't matter what your zip code is. It doesn't matter what your bank account says. It doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters. exposure is key, and we should all be allowed to experience, to have that experience, the same experience that Curtis had that took him from nothing to the top of the world. We should all have it.
Is the Delaney Foundation an actual foundation?
Only in my head, only in my head. No, it's not. There are several organizations that do provide instruments and support for teachers and lessons and students, but it's not on as a wide a scale as the Delaney Foundation in these stories.
Okay, all right. But yeah, but parents, you know, should be looking out for these things. Mm-hmm.
And take advantage of them, please.
Right. Your book goes from D.C. to the Kennedy Center to several states, and then we're out of the country. It's a really highly visual book. So I'm wondering, has this or any of your books been optioned for film? Because I could see this, you know, I could just see sitting in a theater or watching Netflix or whatever and seeing this book. It's really very exciting.
Thank you for saying that. I really do appreciate it. I can just say that there may be something in the works for all three of my novels. You know, I always try to write my stories. All the books that I've written, I write them like I'm watching a movie. And to me, that's how I want to be entertained. And I'm glad that that's actually being experienced by other readers. That's fantastic.
For sure.
You really did take us for quite a ride in this novel. So many different places. I just kept thinking, whoa, how did he come up with all these little places? And the other thing, I was on the ride, and I'm always thinking of where we're going. But you know what? I was way out there. I did not guess at all that's where we were going.
Well, that's good. That means I did my job well.
Some of the places we went were, the little places were unusual. Can you say a little bit about your settings?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, I learned from witness protection from my friend who was the marshal, who gave me a lot of information. When you go into witness protection, you basically have no say in where it is that you're going to end up. Like, you know, you go through a series of interviews and they say, what place would you like to live? Oh, I want to live in LA. I want to live in Hawaii. I want to live in Dallas. And those top three or top five, whatever places, they're automatically excluded from your list. Like, nope, because if you're telling us that you want to go there, you probably told someone else that you want to go there, and that would be a good place for the criminals to start looking. So if you're going into witness protection and you really want to live in Los Angeles, don't say you want to live in Los Angeles. So, you know, these places that someone with Curtis, Zippy, and Larissa's backgrounds would have absolutely no concept of living, you know, these small cities like Phoenix. Go from DC to Phoenix, it's like, huh, that is a big change. That's a really big jump. And then go back down to the South. I think it was Columbia, South Carolina that I put in the book. You'll have to forgive me. I've read this book 24 times, but I haven't read it in a minute. But and just some of those places, the most unlikely I picked, the most unlikely settings for anyone to want to settle in from DC were the spots that I usually chose them to go to. And the whole, when they arrived in Costa Rica, that was because, you know, there was an organ harvesting ring going on there. And I did a little bit of research, and believe it or not, no offense to my Costa Rican brothers and sisters out there, but yeah, there's some shady stuff that goes on as far as that's concerned in Costa Rica. So I chose that spot.
Whoa. Well,
now, are you going on a tour with this book? And if so, is Portland one of the places?
I actually am on tour right now. I have been North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Texas, California, Chicago. I've been all over the country, and I'm actually taking a break in July so I can start writing my next book. But Portland right now is not on my tour calendar unless someone gets in touch with my publicist and says, hey, what's up with bringing Brendan to Portland?
You said something earlier that triggered this question. How much more time can editing add to the completion of a book? You do the book, and how comfortable are you as an author with the changes that editors might ask you to make?
Well, to answer the first part of that question, if you submit a draft and you think it's great and you love everything in it, and your editor goes over it and he can tell you to add things or tell you to delete things. And with that, moving on to the second part of the question, if you've got to trust your editor, you've got to trust the person that you're putting your work into their hands. I trust my editor 100% completely. He has given me ideas for things that I never would have thought, I never would have conceived of. In my first, and actually all of these books that I've written, he has been phenomenal. And you know, you need less of this. I would do more of this. What is this person actually going through? We're not seeing it on the page. We need more of that, you know, and mine is phenomenal. If you trust your editor, then you trust him 100% to give you the ideas that it's going to make a successful novel. And I'm very fortunate to have a very, very, one of the best, I think. And I trust him completely. So anything he says do, I will absolutely do it. I rarely have any arguments with my editor when he says take something out or add something. That is a very rare occasion because I trust him completely.
Just a little add to that. Say, starting with your first novel, mm-hmm. were you able to choose your editor, or are you, you're assigned an editor and it works or it doesn't?
Well, the editor, I had no say so in, and I'm so glad that I didn't, because I was brand new to this, you know, field. And when I looked him up and I saw what he had done and who he had worked with, I was like, oh yeah, this guy. Yes, absolutely. I love this guy's books. I love this guy's books. I love this guy's books. And if he had anything to do with that, I absolutely would love to be on his team. So, oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
You mentioned a new book that you'll be working on. Will it be musical?
100%. I am going to be the Stephen King of musical thrillers. That is going to be my position. I will wear that crown. I will. My next book is going to deal with a pianist, and that's really all I can say without giving anything away, but I'm really excited to start writing, and we shall see. Hopefully I'll be done before the summer is out, and it, you know, may or may not be published next year.
Brendan, thank you so much for coming back and talking with us about your new book, Dark Maestro. And when you do finish the new book, we hope to hear from you again. And I know the people listening are hoping to hear from you again.
Thank you very much. It would be my pleasure and an honor to come back and talk about my next book. And I thank you guys so much for having me here today.